had to move the time of the appointment or for our show because I was getting my head shrunk.
Well, you're in a good mental state. Let's all get together.
Welcome to the Tragedy Academy, a show created to bridge societal divides in a judgment-free zone using candor and humor. We are joined today by Scott Edwards. How are you doing today, Scott?
Hey, I'm a little more excited. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Scott Edwards. Thank you. Thank you.
There it is.
Nice to have you here.
I love the cheese. Gary's going to be mad he missed that. He fell out as soon as we started, which is amazing. See, here's the thing about this show. Like I was saying when we came, it's tragedy.
Yeah.
Right? It's baked into the name.
It is the Tragedy Academy, which, you know, begs for a little foreboding when you come on as a guest. But being on the, you know, the comedy side, the business side, I felt like I could bring some balance to your show.
Absolutely do believe that. I think comedy is an extremely effective tool for change, for understanding, for bridging societal divides. It's part of the reason why the logo is what it is. It's a yin-yang. It's, you know, sadness and happiness. And if anybody embodies that, it's someone that's worked in the comedy industry and seen some of the most tortured souls that have ever walked the earth with the most pure comedy genius and views of reality. Scott, tell us what you do and where you come from.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Scott Edwards. I'm out of the Northern California area, but what Jay's alluding to is that I owned a chain of comedy clubs from, yes, I'm an older guy, from 1980 to 2001. When I opened the club, it was the 12th full-time comedy club in the entire U.S., and wow, it is still operating today, not under my tutelage, but it's still out there, so it's now one of the oldest clubs in the country, and I'm very proud of that. And I did get a chance to work with a lot of narcissistic, damaged goods people, but you know what? They were damn funny.
I don't
funny.
Think narcissistic. There are some, but I feel like the comedian world is filled with open wounds.
Well, they're not all bad or all messed up.
I just feel like there's something that has happened that's a catalyst to the sarcasm, to the way that things are approached. I mean, look at people like Mitch Hedberg.
Oh,
you
yeah,
know,
Mitch
or Greg Giraldo.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Robin Williams. Like, I'm going straight into the most horrible scenarios. But we're talking about people that were comedic geniuses and wore some of the darkest, you know, mental health issues out in front of everybody.
Yeah, Bill Hicks, Bobcat Goldthwait, Paula Poundstone, they all had Emo Phillips. I mean, talk about esoteric and strange. There was some real interesting personalities that came through the clubs, but you're right. Most of them had a background of what you and I were talking before you hit record about the average American family, where we all have some tragedy and drama in our lives, that in our youth that tends to affect who we are later. But then there's others that Jerry Seinfeld, one of the funniest guys in America, you know, came from a fairly normal upper middle class, you know, family, and he still has a great observation of the world and shares it comedically. And he's still outperforming today, even though he could buy and sell Trump.
Probably could. And you're not wrong. I think that I talk about like experiences are like lenses and glasses, and that you get different prescriptions over time based on what you've been through. I feel like your comedic voice does have that same set of filters that has what you put out based on what you've gone through and how you perceive things, and you find your people, so to speak, that feel you. They're on the same wavelength. That humor hits the same funny bone on both sides.
Well, I think that's, you're pointing out something that's so important in any sort of entertainment, but especially in stand-up comedy, Jay, and that is being able to relate to the audience. And so what's interesting is that people take their pain, find the funny in it, and then they share it with an audience. And 9 times out of 10, the audience has been through or known somebody that's been through a similar circumstance. And bringing the funny to it really helps everybody It's cathartic. It, you know, that helps them get over it and move on. And it's
there's strength and vulnerability, even if you hide it behind a laugh or a joke.
Right.
Allowing everybody exactly. to see it, it makes things so much better. Misery loves company, but also enlightenment loves friends, right? When you're sitting together, you don't want to be the only dude that understands the scenario. That makes it really crappy every day. But if you have the chance to stand up there and bridge some divides as a comedian, the reason why I love it is you can call out some of the worst and most heinous fallacies in society, but you're not pointing at a person in the room. You're doing a test, a climate test. You're allowing somebody that may be that offending person with inside of a larger group that is not aware of how heinous it is that they do these things every day until everybody in the room laughs, claps, and does all these things. And the offenders in the room,
Well, there's you know some truism there. To that, Jay. Gary is back with us. Hi, Gary. Are you still there?
What's going on, brother?
Hey, you know, it is interesting that you bring up and you approach comedy this way, Jay, because it is, you're going a little, a level deeper than the average audience thinks about. You know, they go in, they're paying money, so they're vested in being entertained, and they want to hear funny stuff. What they don't usually understand, at least going in, is that to be really funny and to connect with the audience, the comic needs to talk about something that relates to the majority of the people in the room. And that's what kind of brings the group together. For example, you know, somebody says that, you know, or talks about the challenging relationship with their father or something, and the comic is poking fun at it and finding the funny in these challenging relationships. Well, it's not just one guy or one woman in the audience that might relate to that. They think it's just them. We all think,
right.
You know, our world is special and
we're
unique.
We're so narcissistic
right.
as a being.
But the reality is, then, you know, you hear the comic telling his story and finding the funny, and then, oh, wow, that is funny. And then you see everybody else laughing, and you go, oh, I'm not the only one with a screwed up father. Oh, I get it. Okay. And that helps, is cohesive for the audience and brings them together. Agreed. And what's really neat from a producer's point of view, which is my role, was that that group of people is sharing an experience that will never happen again, because every audience is different. Every line is different. Even a comic that does the same bit every night,
still different.
Yeah. It's always a nuance, and the audience is always different. And so the reaction is always different, and who's relating is always different. A lot of people don't realize what's really fascinating about stand-up comedy versus, you know, let's say music or a play or a movie, is that the moment, that live aspect of it that everybody is bonding and relating to is, in my mind, magical, because it'll never happen again.
That's an amazing way to look at it. And you're not wrong. We live in the now. So there is no future. There is no past. And if you're definitely sitting there together, if you're not taking in that same energy from everybody else in the room, you're the odd man out. We know who that person is. They're the one saying something from the side. I did watch this video on TikTok the other day. I love stand-up, right? And there was a video of this comedian, and I cannot remember his name, but he had made a joke about autism for whatever reason. I didn't hear it, but there was a woman, and it cut right into it where the woman was, you know, kind of interjected, I didn't like what you said about autism. I have a son with autism, or somebody with autism in the family. And he just stood there and looked at her for a while. And then, you know, basically he's like, so you realize now that it's probably an awkward scenario that you've pointed this out and I'm still looking at, and you don't really know what to do. And basically what it came down to was, you're actually a poster child for the understanding of autism, because you are going to recognize the social cues and realize that you probably shouldn't be cutting into a comedian set. And you can hear the woman, yeah,
Like, yeah, she realized.
She had oversold it. And I don't even, this isn't like the anti-autism podcast.
Well, no, but it's interesting because I have a comic, Greg Schwimm, that does a whole bit about autism. And it's because his daughter has autism. And so to deal with the tragedy of an emotionally challenged child, he finds the funny in it. And then by going on stage and talking about the unique situations that happen with his daughter, he's bringing the audience along on a journey, on a story that educates them about autism and also makes them realize that despite the difficulties and the challenges, there's a lot of love and joy that he has with his daughter because of her special nature. And so it enlightens the audience while entertaining him.
And I firmly believe that that's the best way to convey change. By shedding light, there's strength and vulnerability. When someone like that gets on stage and says those things, you are correct about everything that you said. And there's also an additional byproduct. You're giving the people that are actively living in that scenario a voice. You're showing them that they're allowed to speak out loud about what they're going through with their, you know, family member that might have that particular special need. That's worth its weight in gold.
Well, we've seen it a lot recently on even America's Got Talent, where you've had some people with physical disabilities that are getting on and they're still funny by poking fun at their own disabilities. And what it does is it not only makes them a hero because they've overcome their challenges and found the humor and are able to share it, but for the world that's watching them, they're going, you know, because I have a physical disability doesn't mean I can't be funny or I can't entertain. And that's an important message, as you said. It's sharing a positive thing. But we're on the Tragedy Academy. So maybe, you know, we're going the wrong way.
No. Honestly, I think that tragedy creates comedy.
No.
I mean, in retrospect, you have to laugh at things, right?
Yeah.
No, I mean, you're not wrong. You know, a lot of people tune into this show, they jump on, they're like, oh, it's about people's tragedies. And I'm like, no, it's not. Like, take 2 seconds. First of all, Google what non-pura scala means. It's on the bottom of the logo. If you take this place seriously, you're an idiot because it means not a real school, right?
You put it there. I mean, it's in
I wish I went to a fake school.
Plain as day. Well, it's an academy. You don't put, like, you know, eat at Joe's in regular language on the bottom of a batch. I put non-purist scholem, right? So it's...
Well, let's give you a tribute for being original.
Here we go. Love it. Gary, man, how you doing there? Now, he lives in the land of comedy as well. There's a lot of comics that come through where he lives, so I'd love to hear your take on it, man.
Well, you know, I was thinking about when you talk about the autism bit, Shane Gillis is one of my favorite current comedians, and he's got a bit about his uncle with Down syndrome, and he got tons of shit about it. And, you know, he makes like good points. He's like, you know, all these people are on antidepressants and Zoloft. He's like, my uncle's on Capri Suns. He's the fucking happiest guy I know. Like, you know, it's kind of like...
You're not wrong, man.
People, yeah, like they want to talk about, or they don't want you to talk about anything, not about our differences, not about handicaps or perceived handicaps. And like comedy should be mostly off limits for the PC culture, I think. Well, like that's where we get it all things. Out.
The people that go to a comedy show and then turn around and complain and whine or get into their wokeness, I'm going, what the fuck are you doing at a comedy show?
Thank you.
Don't go. And then the other thing is that stand-up comedy and entertainment really in general, but we're still focused on stand-up comedy. My background is a reflection of the world. And the world has tragedy. The world has diseases. The world has special people. The world has troubled lifestyles and child raising that creates a situation. And the value that stand-up comedy, I think, brings to it is that it pokes fun at it. That, it, exactly. You know, it's like what you said in your logo, the yin and yang, right? Yes, there's going to be hard times. We've all go through hard times. That's called life. And comedy helps you balance that, helps you poke fun at it, helps you realize that, yeah, you may have challenging times, go through a bankruptcy, go through a divorce, have a somebody in your family pass away. These are all parts of life. So if you, if a comic can poke fun at that, find the funny, you're going to help balance and get through it that much better.
The military is worth its weight in gold. It's the military has made its whole entire life out of that. You know, you make jokes in the darkest times of things when you're going through shit or when you're training or whatever. You know, Gary knows that in the, you know, the film industry, you guys end up dealing with so many situations where you're just stuck sitting around, sucking your thumbs, doing BS, playing spades or some crap. You know, that's just kind of how it breaks down.
Well, to interrupt, Jay, what are the happiest, funniest people? Morticians. They deal with death every day, and they all have a great sense of humor. Why?
Because they're okay with death.
Yeah, they have to get through what they deal with every day, and they do that with a good sense of humor. I'm a mortician and get a laugh.
I was about to say, I think everybody should probably have to do like a tour in the mortuary for like, you know, a couple of months. Because I feel like a lot of the hangup that we have in the human experience is the not ability to cope with the fact that we're going to die.
Yeah.
We don't understand it. So we spend so much time spinning yarns, getting on stages, making jokes about the human experience, singing to each other, building buildings, all this other shit, all because we don't want to look at the finish line. The thing that we know that's coming, dude, it's there.
Yeah.
It's not like it's going to run away.
It's kind of hard to miss.
We'll run backwards just to never fucking see it.
Yeah. Back when I was a senior in high school, one of my buddies had a job at a mortuary and we would meet there and play poker every week.
Oh, did you play on someone's stomach? Like,
no, but it would be pretty funny because
it gets the seat between the legs. Yeah.
No, my buddy would have to leave the game because he had to go pick up a body. But it was, you know, it just puts right in front of you the fact that we're all mortal and we all have problems and issues. And one of the ways, besides therapy or other things, is to be able to laugh at the circumstances in our lives that are challenging. And the really good comics, you mentioned a few that had some, Robin Williams is a great example of somebody that had some fairly deep issues and had some challenges in his own life. And yet to the rest of the world, his machine gun style of comedy found humor for anything and everybody. And that's a big part of why he was so successful.
He was very successful, but man, did his eyes look tired. He looked like he was living such a life behind that I was fatigued for him. I loved him dearly. Like, he was one of my favorite comedians. And I mentioned off all those ones that passed away, but you've worked with most of the comics that are on this side of the dirt. So maybe we take a moment and talk about that. Influential comedian that you think you've come across?
Well, I've made it a point of not mentioning favorites because just like life and any other industry, but especially in entertainment, for example, you know, you'll talk about, well, there's acting and I'm a certain type of actor. Well, there's comedy actors, there's Shakespearean actors, you know, there's, you know, physical actors. So in comedy, you have such a variety that, for example, when it came to comedy and magic, one of my heroes was Harry Anderson, who people may remember from Cheers and Night Court. For stand-up comedy, he's not famous, but if everybody goes to the Googler and looks up Larry Miller, he was part of the Funniest Men in the Universe out of New York. One of the funniest guys ever on stage, done thousands of TV shows and movies, and yet his name's not famous like, you know, a Leno or a Seinfeld, who, by the way, all these guys work for me. One of the things about Robin that people don't realize is that he was so manic on stage. Off stage, he was very soft-spoken, quiet, a little introverted, and just a fascinating group of people I got a chance to work with, I got to tell you.
Did you ever get to do anything with Mitch Hedberg?
Oh, yeah. Mitch worked for me a few times. He was out of the Bay Area. Oh, man, dude. And him and Arj Barker, Frank Prinze, there was a few of these guys that were kind of...
You know, I love some deadpan comedy, man.
Yeah.
You know, really do.
Great ways to approach comedy. But there's are a lot of unique ways. You know, Paula Poundstone got her start at, she came out from Boston, one of her first clubs she ever worked professionally and traveled at was my club. And she was the only act that I ever let work multiple weeks as she kind of found her humor and found her comedy on stage. And she went on to fame and fortune, is still performing. But Paula's got a lot of baggage when it comes to her family, and it made her just a little off skew. But the audience, she took the audience along that journey. She kind of introduced herself, explained why she was a little off kilter, and then she could do what she wanted. She used to lay down on stage and hold the mic and just talk to the audience while laying down, or put a leg up on a stool. You know, the audience,
you gave them verbal stage to work on. You told them what it was going to look like before they started, so they were okay with you being a lunatic.
Right.
I like this.
Yeah. You know, if you set the audience up, now there, you know, some people have made the mistake of just going out and, you know, and the audience.
I can't stand those kind of comics.
Yeah. And the audience is a little taken aback, but if the person's funny, the audience will catch up. I preferred, as a producer, the comics that found a way to kind of introduce themselves with either a joke or a story or something in kind of warm the audience, brought the audience along. I've mentioned a couple of times, take the audience on a journey, give them a story, and then the jokes fit into it. It's so easy for the audience to follow along, get engaged, and really enjoy themselves.
So I'm curious.
I think everybody's...
No, go ahead, Gary.
I think everybody in comedy's like been through some shit. You know, very rarely do you hear about the like two parents, their accountants, went to a really nice school, you know, graduated top of their class, married their high school sweetheart, two kids in the suburbs. Like, you know, Paula Poundstone was like an asexual alias from Alabama, I think she said, or asexual atheist from Alabama. Is what she described herself as once. And I'm like, asexual atheist. Yeah, that makes sense. Like, that was probably fun.
Triple A, man. Dial that number and see what you get.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't even say it. But, you know, but like, she had to find you, you know, you got to find the comedy in that. And like, if you're weird, it's because you're being yourself most of the
time.
There
you go.
Not because you're trying to be weird, you know?
And that goes back to what Jay was saying. You have to be real. You know, when somebody goes out and pretends to be something, the audience is... You're smart. They're gonna figure that out, and you have to be yourself. And sometimes that's good. Sometimes it's bad, and you have to work through it. But the audience is, and I don't know if you could say they're smart, but they are aware of what's going on and can figure it out. And
I agree with you. Yeah. I think I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this new style of comedy with the interaction that people have, like Matt Rife, where he's talking with the audience about their lives and asking questions, you know, what do you do? What do you think about that? That's funny. You know, it's definitely, it's a comedic style that we've seen in the past. There are comedians that have talked to the audience and you know, interacted like that. But I feel like his is a different kind of off the cuff interaction. And I'm seeing more and more comedians that are attempting it. Now, while he is really good at it, some are pretty good. Others, it's just kind of funny to watch, you know, somebody ask a class of people weird questions.
Well, it's another one of those styles of comedy that have had success over the years. But I was, for example, I was the MC, master of ceremonies of all of my shows. And whether it was television, radio, big concerts, or my clubs, with just anywhere from, you know, 20 to 200 people, the MC's job is to get the audience focused, to get them engaged, and to kind of, in a sense, calm them down and remind them that it's about what's happening on stage and not necessarily about them. That comes into play when you have a bunch of drunk guys or a bachelorette party or something, right? So the MC's job is to interact with the audience, talk with the audience, make them feel special, kind of get them, you know, give them their 2 seconds. Great example. I just mentioned a bachelorette party, or let's say it's a birthday party. Drunken bachelorettes are the worst. But what you do is the MC is that you talk to them, you give them some attention, you poke a little fun at them, get the audience to understand that that group is going to be louder than, let's say, the rest of the group. You know, the group of Mormons over here might not be quite as loud as the drunk bachelorettes. But the MC's job is to try to work through that and let them have their moment so that when the comics come on, it's about them engaging with the audience versus about the group of drunk people, whoever it is. So audience interaction can be very, I think it's necessary and important in any show. However, only some acts make it a major part of their act, right? Like you were saying, is a good example. Most comics use the audience in a little bit of interaction just to move their own comedy along. Right. You know, so I have some jokes about flying in an airplane. So, you know, hey, who's traveled recently? Oh, yeah, good. Okay. Now, and then it goes into his airplane jokes and his traveling jokes. Right. It helps segue from one topic to another in a comedy set.
I like that. I think it's really cool. I also see that comedians are very smart. And now that you've explained that the way that you did, I could see how a comedian that leans on that style as their comedic style, or authentically, they're just gifted at speaking to people openly and off the cuff. I could see how someone could utilize that master of ceremony scenario before they came out there to kind of take notes on where things are and the best areas to kind of poke at. If you see the area that's good at dark humor and they're really reacting well, then when you come out there, you know, if you had a xylophone, that would be the one you'd hit for your C note. Like, ding, I want that one.
Right.
You know, this guy's going to love what we're about to do.
Well, I've had several comics tell me, professionals, explain that they basically had some, what would you call them, litmus test jokes, where they would do those early to kind of see how far they could go with the audience, or where the head of the audience is. It's interesting. People don't think about it. When you have 150, 200 people as an audience, to the comic, it has to be one group, right? You can't make the whole show about these 10 people or those 20 people. You have to try to entertain all of them. So you might want to go out and get the temperature or the mental state of the audience. You know, if you are working in a pool hall and everyone's distracted and semi-intoxicated, you're going to do a certain type of material, maybe a little edgier, maybe a few more F-bombs, maybe something a little more physical. Whereas if you have an older audience, let's say over 40 or 50, and they're a little calmer, okay, I'm going to do this material, right? Or present it in a little bit different tempo than I might this group. And the other challenge or interesting aspect of stand-up comedy that a lot of the audience doesn't realize is in a comedy club's a great example. And Gary, you see this at shows in Vegas all the time. Sometimes there's 100, 200, 500 people in the audience, but sometimes there's 15, 20. And guess what? That comic still has to do his show and entertain. And so you may present your material differently.
Oh, that's sad magician, sad comic. Those guys are, when you see them, they're just curmudgeoned, hating life. The guy's fucking top hat opens like a Campbell's soup can, and the fucking rabbit's in there smoking a cigarette.
Oh, wow. You've been doing some shrooms, man. That was a good image.
Yeah.
I love those situations. They make me laugh because it's like ultimate failures are always funny to me. I've been a big fan. Like, if you stub your toe in front of me, unless you broke it and slapped your kid and knocked him unconscious, I'm probably going to laugh at you every single time.
I'm laughing twice as hard. Slap your kid. So that's pretty funny.
I'm with you, man.
I do like that.
You brought up. Yeah. I'm always this way.
Yeah. Yeah.
100%.
We've had a couple of shroom experts on recently, too.
So I love that you said setting that benchmark or trying to get the understanding for how the crowd is. And one of the best comedians I've seen in a long time at this is Anthony Jeselnik. He will come out and lay out a joke that'll make you rethink your life and why you're laughing at it and whether or not you should be there and what you're witnessing. Last time I went to see him, I watched four people get up within the first 5 minutes, just upset with life at the things that he was saying.
That's their fault. But you got to know where you're going.
I think bought their parents tickets to Jeselnik and didn't tell them because that's what it looked like was leaving. I was like,
sometimes the audience is caught off guard, and as the club owner, I would get complaints and I go, look, you know, stand-up comedy is the last bastion of free speech. And going back to, you were talking about the more recent woke audiences and stuff, you know, the audience also has a responsibility to understand what stand-up comedy is. Now, I don't go for the guys that are very abusive and swearing for no reason or the whole show's about someone's vagina. You know, that might be their style, but that's my job as the producer, as the club owner, is to entertain the masses, you know. I had a little bit different perspective. Now the comic would say, hey, I'm the artist, this is free speech, I want to talk about what I want to talk about, but me as the club owner, as the producer, I have a responsibility to the audience who paid to get in. And so I want them to be entertained. So there is that kind of yin and yang again, where,
right,
yeah, comedy is all about free speech, but whoever's responsible for the show, which is the producer, wants to make sure the audience knows what they're getting into, but also that the comic understands that he has responsibility to entertain the audience. I have a quick story that is a good analogy to this. Bill Maher, very famous political comic, when he was playing clubs back in the day, was the one of only two comics in my career that I fired midweek. And what it was that Bill came out on a Wednesday night. There's maybe 50, 75 people in the audience, Wednesday quiet night. And Bill Maher goes out and he starts his political rant, and he's talking about senators and in-house people in the Capitol and the government, and throwing out names of people that 9 out of 10, you know, the audience never heard of. And Bill's about halfway through a set, and he just stops because the audience isn't with him. He's talking over their head, and they're not laughing. And he just stops and says, you guys are all fucking idiots, and he walks off the stage. Well,
I love that.
Well,
Why do I love that? It wasn't good.
It's just ultimate failure.
Yeah. So I fired him because even though he was doing what he wanted to do and he was doing his political rant, he was getting paid to entertain an audience that paid, right? There's this financial connection.
Know your audience.
He had to, his job was to entertain, and he missed it. Right. He missed that. And, you know, if we had taken the time to give a IQ test to everybody that came in through the door, you know, maybe it would have gone differently. But one of the roles of an entertainer, whether it's musician, actor, magician or ventriloquist or comic, you have to entertain. That's bottom line. So you may lose a few people here and there, but still you want to, you know, your job, what you're getting paid for is to entertain a group of people. I'm talking in circles because I started about the right of free speech for the entertainer, but that's balanced with the responsibility to the audience. Does that make sense?
The financial issue will always taint art to a certain degree because we've made the artist have to produce their art for their biosurvivability tickets when it comes to interacting with life. That means that they're going to have to widgetize a certain amount of their jokes. They're not always going to be able to get up there and play to their friends. Right. They're going to have to get up there and play to the audience. And that sucks, but that's the society we've created. You don't get to go out there and tell all your jokes. They need a couple of like live, laugh, loves from Home Goods on the wall too.
Well, plus you took the job. He took the job to entertain. So there was some responsibility there. Right.
If he was
on his own show, which he did later, he was very successful on TV, still is, or radio, and he wants to go off and talk about every, bullshit guy in the government and all their stuff, that's totally his right. But when he's taking on the job and responsibility of entertaining, that should be the first priority. Now, I'm a producer. That's my opinion. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of artists that would disagree and say, well, free to speech, you know, all the other stuff. So it is interesting. There's a lot of dynamics that people don't think about. You know, something that's kind of interesting, Gary may be able to relate to this more being in Vegas, but when you're a club owner, you're providing a show for an audience. So you're the producer of the show, but guess what? You're also a restaurant owner because you have to serve food, and you're a bar owner because you have to sell alcohol, right? So, and you're a customer service person because you have to entice the people in, and you're a marketer and promoter because you have to get people to the door. I mean, there's so many hats you have to wear.
I got tired hearing that.
Like, yeah, it's a lot.
Who wants to deal with jokes and chicken wings on two different sides? Well, unless it's at my table, I don't want to have to worry about it.
That's the best way to put it, Jay.
No, thank you. That sounds like a lot of work. Too. I mean, you're not wrong, though. That's a skill. That's a special person. Gary's been a producer for the better part of, almost 2.5 decades.
Yeah, I think Vegas is a different animal, too, because if you're in a smaller town, people are going to see that comedian probably, or they're comedy fans. People come to Vegas and they're just like, hey, what's showing at the showroom tonight? And Vegas. Then they'll go. And then you might get a comedian that you weren't expecting to see. I went to see Bob Saget in the 90s and I didn't know anything about his comedy.
He's so good on Full House. Danny Tanner, let's go see him.
We went to a Cavs game. And my buddy's like, my dad got 4 tickets to Bob Saget and he's not going. Like, yeah, you guys want to go after the game because it's downtown Cleveland. And I'm like, Full House guy? I'm like, I don't want to do that. And like, my buddy's like, no, he's fucking hilarious. I'm like, whatever. So we get in there and I'm still getting my drink. And he's like, sorry, I'm late. I was getting a blowjob behind the dumpster. God, the sluts here are not what they used to be. And I'm like,
whoa, like, Danny.
I'm like, whoa. And it wasn't just the shock. Because then I thought in my head, I'm like, is he just going to like say this kind of shit now?
That was Andrew Dice Clay for an hour.
No, yeah, Danny Tanner on Full House and Fuller House, that was acting. True Bob Saget, who, by the way, very, very dear friend, was one of the nicest guys in the business. He helped me get started back in 1980. Him and Dave Coulier were some of the original guys.
Hold on, cut it out.
They were on my TV show. They did my 10th anniversary show, but they were also there for the first few weeks. It was Dave Coulier who I saw in a satellite room for the Comedy Store in Westwood, California. I saw Dave and I was just an audience person, and I go, man, this is in 1979. And I go, this is amazing. I love stand-up comedy. And I waited and I met Dave and he introduced me to Sandra Bullhart, George Wallace, and a few others. And I literally drove home with my head going, how am I going to start my own comedy club? By the time I got back to Sacramento, I quit my job. I went bankrupt in, I think it was six 8 weeks later, I opened up my club. And then Dave came up and he brought Bob Saget. And they were integral in the beginning of my career in comedy. But Bob was one of those guys that on TV was Danny Tanner from Full House, Fuller House, or America's Funniest Videos. Both him and Dave hosted that for a while. On stage was a whole different guy. He was a musician, did a lot of music and singing. It was always dirty. But it was interesting because it wasn't like F-bomb dirty. It was actually intelligent, creative humor. That's the way to put it, Jay.
That's why I like Jeff Ross.
Oh, yeah. Jeff Ross, same way.
Genius.
Very, very funny, but definitely going to push the boundaries. And the guy's father that gave up the tickets would not have enjoyed the show as much as you, right, Gary?
He would have walked out like they did in Jeselnik when I was there.
Yeah, he was like a banker, insurance type guy, and like he worked in like a big office downtown, and he would always get tickets to like random shit, you know? And so like he would definitely have not enjoyed it like we did. And we were like 19 or 20. Probably maybe 21.
That's a perfect time.
Late
90s.
Hit all the buttons for you.
Yeah, it was shock value at first, but then funny. It wasn't just him trying to be shocking. Like I remember.
And like, that's why
it's good.
Yeah, people thought that after being on Full House, he was trying to, shock his audience. No, he was like that back in the late 70s and early 80s as a stand-up comic. He was very edgy. Very funny. He did a lot of music, which people didn't know, but the songs were always about getting laid or sex or something. But it was a funny stuff, creative.
Absolutely. Yeah, he ran with a really cool crew.
He was great. It's sad that we lost him the way we did. In fact, he was already scheduled to be on my podcast when he had passed. It was unexpected, but a great, great man and very funny.
Yeah, very funny. I think he's like underrated in the actual comedy because his show is so successful that obviously people remember him from that. But as a stand-up, like I think I've heard a lot of comics say he was their favorite comic.
Because he was so like real and he was a comics comic. He really related and helped other people. Of helping in 1981, sorry to date myself, my club was just about a year old, and Bob, without getting paid, wrote and starred in my first two TV commercials. And on one of the commercials, he threw me off a roof, and on one of the commercials, he hit me with a car. It was my car.
Nice.
But those commercials were so fun to do, and Bob, wrote them. It kind of directed them and starred in them, and it helped get my club going.
Dude, you can't make up stories like that.
Hey,
you really can't.
Oh well,
like yeah, that's the real deal.
Yeah, and if you want to see the videos, hey, go to my network.
We'll definitely share links to that. I mean, if I had the technology, I would look it up right now. I love watching people. Doing stupid shit.
It's so stupid.
Sounds like something I would do.
You want to hear something stupid? I'm watching. The tragedy side of this. I'm shooting my first TV commercial. I'm just a kid. I'm like 24 years old. And Bob and another comedian, Carrie Snow, are in my car. And they're driving along pretending, what are we going to do tonight? Hey, let's go see. What are we going to do tonight? They hit me. And I slide up on the windshield and I'm wearing a shirt that says Laughs Unlimited, the name of my club. And Bob goes, hey, comedy, let's do that. Well, this body's laying on the car. Well, what was funny was I was you know, getting hit by a car, throwing myself up on it, I broke my windshield.
Oh, no. See, again, this is something I would do.
Yes.
Like, I can see myself attempting all of this and ending up with a broken windshield and a wife looking at me like, I married you. Why did I pick you to tame? Yeah. By the way, that's what women do. They just find us and tame us. And she picked me and she's pissed.
Oh, well, like, she just likes get,
she doesn't get mad at me. She looks at me. She looks at me disappointed in herself. I don't know how I feel about it.
They measure up like, to who they married. Yeah, I lucked out. I decided instead of finding a young lady to marry, I just raised one of my own. My wife came to work for me when she was 19. She was a hostess, and I was married to somebody else. And fast forward 15 years, and she and I get married, and she ends up owning half the company. So. You know, it, I,
when it's right, it's right.
Yeah. Well, she's a lot younger than me, which is nice for me, but, I'm sure a little bit of a challenge for her.
You never look at it through their eyes.
Push the wheelchair a little faster.
I don't consider myself a prize. I passed my shelf life. I know that when my wife sees me walking across the room, she's not saying hubba hubba. Like hubba hubba went out the window like a long time ago.
Those days are gone, right?
I am all comedy. That's the only way I'm getting anything down in my house. I've got to make jokes and act stupid. Otherwise, it ain't happening.
You know, another act that you guys should check out, or your audience should check out if you haven't seen him, is Dana Carvey.
Love Dana Carvey.
Dana, everybody knows him from Saturday Night Live. And then, of course, he had a couple successful movies. But back in the early 80s, he was just getting started out of the San Francisco Bay Area. And great, this guy work. Did voices. Yeah. He did music, Chopping Broccoli and Burger King song.
Broccoli.
He had great observational comedy. He could do dialects. He was so entertaining. His range of entertainment was amazing. The reason I bring up the story and name drop him is that I had a really memorable moment with him. He worked for me a lot. In fact, a lot of the songs he did on Saturday Night Live, he did on my stage. And one week we brought his brother's band in, a full band, and we'd had the full band on stage. So Chopping Broccoli was really funny with just him and the guitar, but you get the whole band and the backup singers. It was incredible. And one of the, I think it was the Thursday night, we got done with the show and we go back to where I kept the comics, and we're sitting in the hot tub having some cocktails with a couple of young ladies. And Dana goes, you know, I just got off the phone with Lorne Michaels and they want me in New York on Monday to try out for Saturday Night Live. I was like, what? That's amazing. You know, bring out the champagne. He was scared to death. He was like, you know, I've been doing comedy for a while, but he hadn't done any real TV and stuff. He had done some small things for me. But he had literally just gotten off the phone with Lorne Michaels and was on his way to Saturday Night Live, which, of course, springboarded him to fame and fortune. Yeah. So being able to share that moment with him was a real keystone in my life.
Yeah, watching somebody navigate those things before they're in the position that we all revere them for, when we're looking at them through those jaded eyes, you know, where we've had this romantic relationship with them through a screen for so long, and then having the ability to see them make those decisions live time and struggle the same way that we do. I always say it, dude, Beyonce gets diarrhea too. Like, if you want to equalize things in life, just imagine that your worst enemy, whatever situation, there is a moment in time where they're doubled over hating life. They are no different than you.
Well,
right?
You're absolutely correct, is that people that we look up to or appreciate as actors or singers or entertainers of any kind are just people. And one of the things that was interesting, Gary, you probably see this as a producer as well. I hired these guys. I'm paying them money. They worked for me. And I saw them as just people. And engage with them that way. So I never had that experience.
I've never been that person either.
What?
I've never been that person either. It my wife, she gets starstruck. She's one of those, you know, people that'll and stare at him and all this kind of stuff. And I'm the guy like that ends up having the beer or the coffee or whatever with this, the person afterwards, or just hanging out, because they, again, they are exactly like us.
Yeah, they're just people.
There's no, but they're just people.
You know, they happen to be very talented people, which is nice.
100%.
And I felt
they're
like
they're setting examples.
Sorry?
We're attracted to them because they're setting an example of what you can do with authenticity.
Right, right. Well, I, for example, I owned a bunch of art galleries and I can't draw a good stick figure, but I had an appreciation for art. And so
producer.
I could interact with artists and have, and I had galleries. I can't, I'm a pretty good MC, to be honest. And some people say I'm funny, but I'm not a stand-up comic. I don't write material. I've never been an actor that, you know, but I respect that talent and the work that goes into it. The professionals, a lot of people don't realize, you know, it may look like that comedy, that stand-up comedy joke they just thought of and is really funny. I know that they work for 5 or 10 years. They probably told that joke 1,000 times. I use the analogy, they get a lump of coal that's an idea, but they have to work it and rework it and rework it, try different ways of doing it and different words. And it ends up to being a gem of a joke. And that's just 30 seconds of their set. Imagine doing that to fill a whole show.
How do you think things have changed with like TikTok and everything, especially with like kind of instant popularity? Guys used to have to work the road and work 2-10 people audiences and kind of grind until they got a name. But now, you know, something could go viral overnight. You think that's affecting the way comedy's done or how it's perceived?
The joke is on the people, because these guys that think they're funny doing a 30-second or 1-minute video and call themselves professionals are everything but. I know of a couple stories. It doesn't happen as much now because people kind of woke up. But about 5-10 years ago, when the internet and all the reels and everything started getting popular, and somebody would say, I have 500,000 followers and I've got 10 really funny 30-second videos. And that some club owner goes, wow, yeah, okay. And pays this guy $10,000 to come in. And guess what? That guy can't do 5 minutes on stage in front of a live audience, right?
So you paid, it's editing.
You paid $10,000 for shit. Because this guy could act like an asshole on a little reel for 30 seconds doesn't mean he's going to be a professional entertainer.
You're not wrong.
You know, no you may have 5,000, you know, 500,000 followers, but those people, if they're smart, wouldn't pay to see your 30 seconds.
I do like the fact, it's though, free, that,
right, Jay?
No, absolutely. But I also like that there's a mechanism for up-and-coming talent to get exposure. Because not all of them are going to be complete and total turds. You know, I mean, again, not to beat a dead horse, but Matt Rife is somebody that came from TikTok. And that guy was grinding before that. That's what a lot of people don't realize.
He was doing the work before, right. And that's
key. Exactly.
But there's the yin and the yang, Jay, that it is true that I don't have the appreciation for a lot of the social media hacks that think they're superstars because they can do 30-second reels.
Oh, no, I didn't say that.
But you are correct, and Gary made the point that it's a stage, it's a format where you can express yourself, find an audience, and work, you know, do, you know, entertain in your way. Does that make you a pro? No. Does that make you, you know, as important as somebody that put in the hard work? No. But it's a beginning place, and that's why my club and all comedy clubs have what's called open mic nights, because you have to have somewhere for people to showcase, get up in front of an audience, and bomb. It's so important to bomb.
100%.
You know, if you don't have failures, I mean, I don't want to sound too theological here, but failures are the stepping stones to success. If you don't go up and bomb on stage, you're not going to succeed on stage. You have to learn the yin and the yang, right, Jay?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I've had a lot of friends, to include Gary, that have been pushing me to do open mic nights. A lot of them have been pushing me in that direction.
Everybody does one or two, because you learn so much about yourself. And at the same time, it's so funny. And this is kind of like TikTok and stuff. There's guys that are the class clowns in school, or they're the funniest guys in their group, or they make their family laugh. Well, that's great, and everybody should have that. But it's a whole different story when you're in front of people that paid to be entertained, right? They have a financial investment in the evening, and if you go up and stink up the stage, guess what? They're going to let you know.
Oh, man, dude. That's the part that bothers me. And I don't want to get too far before I forget. I need to know, what are your thoughts on a tour in a submarine with comics?
Well, that would be a what you call a controlled, confined audience.
Now, Gary, why did I ask him that question? I did ask him that question for a reason.
I'm not really sure.
One of the few people you'll probably ever meet in life that owns or owned a submarine.
Yes, but I was separate from my comedy. I took the money I made in comedy and I built and bought a submarine. I felt I was pretty entertaining on the cruises, but no, we didn't do any comedy. You know, that's maybe why I failed. By the way, that speaking of failures, I lost lots of money on that submarine. It was still so cool to have and so cool to own. But that was one of my
things. Scares the shit out of me. I would never do it.
Huh?
Never do it. No, you could not pay me enough to get in that suicide tube and go there underwater. Like, screw you. I'm not doing it. When I saw those guys, in that story with the guys that, imploded and they were looking at the Titanic, I was like, see, dude, this is natural selection. Other animals don't fucking stop, their friends from doing dumb shit. They let them fall off the cliff.
Well,
we prevent shit, but those people, man, dude, I'm not trying to be mean. Obviously, it's a tragedy.
Right, yada, right. Yada, but I get it.
No, you got to combine it. You got to get what you signed the waiver for.
Exactly. Well, I had the tragedy of losing a ton of money on a submarine, but I also owned a beach shack in Hawaii where I literally sat on the beach and sold sunscreen and rented out beach chairs and kayaks and stuff. And I got to tell you, when you're young and single, having all those women laying out there, it was worth it.
Dude, I imagined some guy accidentally squeezing some Hawaiian Tropic too hard when you said that. It was like...
Well, it was interesting because I think it was last week's show, you had the guy talking about the exploration and figuring out self-love. I'm not sure what the confusion was. I figured out self-love when I was 12.
Yeah.
It's not wrong, dude.
True, man.
I of course listened to several of your shows.
I self-loved myself so much that I had to fucking got in trouble.
But it is, I think it's a great premise for your show and your logo and how you bring the fact that life is full of tragedies. Life is full of the yin and yang, where you have to have both to really not only have a full 100%. Life, but appreciate life. If you don't have the bad times, you're not going to appreciate the good times.
100%. And it's all about what you focus on. It's kind of like going to purchase a new car. If you go and look at that car, you might feel like it was the greatest thing. You hadn't seen one before. This is something original. And as soon as you leave the lot, what do you see? Nothing but that car, right? All you see is that car everywhere. And you're judging the people in it. You're looking at it, you're like, oh man, that's an old lady. Well, I can't have this car. That's an old lady car. It's all about what you focus on. I love the fact that you have grabbed life by the cojones and lived the shit out of it. And you don't seem to be the type of person that lives in the muck. If something gets fucked up, you just turn the page and start writing on a new one. And I see that with your path, because I don't hear, I lost my life in a submarine. No, I owned a fucking submarine. I fucked it up and lost it, but it's fucking great.
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
Well,
you didn't own a submarine, motherfucker.
Yeah. I would say that. You're absolutely correct. And I am a little bit of an oddball, what they call an A personality entrepreneur. I've started over a dozen companies. Some I sold, some failed. I've been filthy rich a couple times. I've been bankrupt a couple times. but it's all part of life's experience. And, you know, I'm like twice as old as you guys. And I just got to tell you, the best is yet to come. You just can't let the failures hold you back. You always have to, as you said, turn the page and get on to the next project. You know,
oh, good,
that didn't work. All right, what's next? You know?
Absolutely, man. You can't sit in shit.
Yeah.
Like, who complains about the smell when they're standing in the actual pile?
Right.
Like, you deserve to smell shit if you're standing in it.
Yeah.
Like, that, and that's what people do. And it's almost like a get-out-of-jail-free card, victimhood.
Yeah.
Because you no longer have to play the game to your fullest capability because you get to hold up a sign that says, I was wrong. I was wrong, so nobody can tell me that I should be doing better or that I can do more or that I can enjoy more. You stand there and hold that sign and expect everybody to hand you change.
Well,
and that's just not the way it works.
Yeah.
Or it's a waste of fucking valuable earth time.
Your time is so valuable. And I think you hit the nail on the head is that in this day and age, you're talking about how things have changed in my lifetime. Everybody wants to be a victim. Now, everybody has something that's holding them back. The man's holding me back, or society, or your judgment. It's all holding me back. And I go, that's the wrong focus. Your focus should be, what can you do to make your life better and bring others with you? You know, you want to, I hope we get past this for the sake of my children and grandchildren, that we get past this phase where everybody's a victim and everybody needs a handout. No, nobody gave me shit. You know, I had to earn and work my way through everything. And yeah, I failed a lot, but I also had some great successes, and that's what made my life interesting. Not to put that on anybody else, but I recommend that from my personal
point
of view,
there's nothing wrong with loving your story and loving how hard you worked and recognizing that other people don't have the same strife to get where they are. Do I feel like there's a certain amount of societal constraint that has given people the only out that they can in order to survive in their scenario? And that is to pull that card. I think there are a lot of people that pull that card because honestly, this same opportunities don't exist for two people, right? And I think some of them have, rather than make theirself, you know, a different chapter, a different story, they go ahead and take that challenge and use it as their victimhood card, right? And sometimes that's just the glasses or lenses that you're delivered. Maybe it's not your tour on the rock where you figure it out. Maybe you'll get it next time. You know, sometimes we're a fan, sometimes we're a player. Right? I'm going to be a player. I'm playing the game.
Well,
like, just like you've had a million careers, I've gone a million different directions, seen a million different things, and hated all of it until now. Dead serious, man. All of that was a joke.
Oh,
careers were a joke. They were all things that other people had told me were going to make me happy.
Until you figured out yourself what was going to make you happy.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. Well, the only thing I would disagree with you on is that I know that some people they feel like they don't have the opportunities, although there's examples all over the world.
They're there.
Of people that get past challenges, past disabilities, past being poor, 100%. Past bad parenting, past all that, and still succeeded. And so my answer to that is that sometimes you have to create your own opportunity. You know, if you're waiting for it to be handed to you, which it may or may not, in most cases it's not, then you have to work for and create your own opportunity. But that's the only caveat I would say to what you said.
Action. That's as simple as it. Success is only created through action. If your ability to create your stars is not fueled by movement, then it's never going to happen. You're just going to sit on the launch pad for the rest of your fucking life blowing smoke, right? And nobody wants the guy. Everybody laughed at the guy that only squealed his tires and never raced.
Wait, I gotta tell you, you have a great way with verbiage, Jay. You should be a writer. Do you do any writing?
No, I do not.
You have a great way of painting a picture. You might want to look into writing because you have a gift.
I genuinely appreciate that. I enjoy just fucking describing things. My cousin calls me the least complex nickname that you could possibly have for me. And he calls me Captain Describo. I
guess when you're right, you're right.
It's the worst description ever. Yeah, he wrote it for me. He just liked the fact that it wasn't anything too intricate. So, Gary, do you have anything you want to wrap up on before we talk to you getting out of here?
I was going to mention, the Tragedy Academy is kind of about that, you know, people that have got the bad lay of the land or, you know, whatever, bad life or bad circumstances, and then kind of have made it through. And some, like you said, you know, many times, you know, up and down, and, you know, I've been like that and I've been at the top of my career and the bottom, top and the bottom. And I think that, you know, you got to just keep pushing through that shit. And don't write the list of reasons that you can't do something. That's always going to be way longer than the reasons you can.
Unless you plan on crossing them off.
Yeah.
Yeah, hey, but you guys have time for one quick short story that brings this all together.
Yes,
absolutely.
Oh, hit me. One of my early acts on stage, he was an opening act making $100 and his first gig out of Phoenix, Arizona. You might have heard of him. Gary Shandling was working my club, and it was a Wednesday night, small audience, like 14 people in the audience. And, he's a pro. He has to go out and do his stuff. So he's out there, and he's doing his act. And this is the challenging part. Halfway through his act, one of the audience members, a guy, got up to go to the restroom. And Gary just stopped. He's already got a small audience, and now it's by percentage just dropped tremendously. So Gary goes, I can't go on like this. Come with me. And he took the other 13 people into the men's room, men and women, went and stood right behind the guy doing his business at the urinal and went on with his act without even taking a beat. And
that's
he's
amazing.
Just doing his jokes. Everyone's laughing. This guy's trying to pee. And it was hilarious. But it was a great example of somebody that had a challenging situation. He's got a small audience. He loses part of it. How am I going to overcome this? I'm going to take the audience into the men's room and finish my show.
He followed intuition. He followed what he thought was the funniest thing in the moment, and it paid off.
Gary Shandling was a master, and that was a moment I'll never forget. And if anyone's wondering, we did make sure the guy washed his hands.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that would have been the most
now
viral thing.
Now I don't touch anybody's phone.
Yeah.
I don't see anybody washing their phone when they leave the toilet, so that's it for me.
Oh, yeah.
Check out. I don't want to touch anybody's phone. Yep. Oh, yeah, there is. I always, one of the things that I would like to see, if anybody out there has the statistics behind when they created those Android head goggles where you put your phone into it and then put it in front of your eyes, right? Kind of like the Oculus, but it's your phone. I want to see the statistics on pink eye.
Oh, yeah, that's shit. That's a shitty situation.
It's going to be interesting.
From the moment that was released and forward, I want to see the spike in numbers for prescriptions for pink eye.
Yeah, that's shitty.
It's going to be a problem for sure. Well, Captain Descripto, can I tell the audience
plug your stuff
podcast?
Yes, please do.
And thank you, sir. Or I'm sorry, Captain. Captain. Ladies and gentlemen, if you enjoy stand-up comedy and you want to hear and learn about stand-up comedy, my podcast, Stand-Up Comedy, Your Host and MC, that's Stand-Up Comedy, Your Host and MC, is available on all podcast platforms. And one week I do great sharing of live entertainment that was done in my clubs and TV shows and concerts. And then the next week I do an interview with a professional from the industry. So there's a great yin and yang and some great information about stand-up comedy. So if you get a chance, it's Stand-Up Comedy, Your Host and MC. You see it there?
Love that. Is that a Yeti?
Yeah.
Check you out, man. You threw down some coin for that that piece of, well, what are they, merch there?
The money I'm making from podcasting.
I look at, when I get like those, they're like, you have to order 10,000 to get this Yeti, and they're about $45 a tumbler. And I'm like, what the? The minimum order alone is like my mortgage.
Yeah, you get some, that's why we get stickers.
Right. Stickers, man. I'll put a sticker on a Yeti.
There you go. Well, tell you what,
Scott, man, you're amazing.
It's been a great talking to you, Jay and Gary. You guys have a great podcast. Your audience is very lucky to have you sharing the yin and the yang, the tragedy and the comedy of life. And it's an important message, and appreciate you being out here.
Likewise, genuinely appreciate you. Thank you for living life by the balls, man. That's what we all need. There's strength in being a lighthouse. I say it all the time, man. If you live your life as hard as you can and do the best that you can, you're not just living your life, you're setting an example for all those around you that it's okay to be themselves.
And you just heard it from Captain Descripto.
Captain Descripto. All right, guys. Remember, everybody, be cool and keep it.